Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, your host and CEO of Bregman Partners. This podcast is part of my mission to help you get massive traction on the things that matter most. We are very lucky today to have with us Krista Tippett. Krista is a Peabody Award-winning broadcaster and New York Times bestselling author. In 2014, she received the National Humanities Medal at the White House for thoughtfully delving into the mysteries of human existence. That is an amazing reason to receive a medal. She's the host of NPR's On Being. I have been listening to her interview really interesting, amazing people in highly engaging ways for at least 10 years. And I'm just so excited, giddy to have Krista on the show with us. The book that we're talking about is Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. Krista, thank you so much for being on the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
I'm really happy to be here.
So, Krista, I'm a little intimidated because you're usually on my side of the aisle, and I really, really adored your book. And I wanted to start by I could do this whole interview just on the introduction of your book, which I felt was so robust. But you wrote in there, "We tried to retire mysteries in the West." Right, and it's so true. And I mentioned this briefly to you before the show. I've written that I don't like personality assessments because they put an answer, an easy answer, to a question that should leave us eternally curious, which is, who are you? Who are you as a person? How are you changing? What's different about you today than you were yesterday? Rather than, oh, you're an ENTJ. I know how to talk to you. And so we try so often in organizations to shortcut a process that would kill mystery and lead us to, you know, answers that allow us to take powerful action and move, you know, forward with ambition. And I want to ask you what your experience is in really delving into and lingering in mystery and bringing that sensibility to your listeners and readers.
Well, I think that, you know, as I write in the book, I think that we're still living with this legacy of the 20th century when, you know, there was such incredible change and progress. And this, you know, if you think about all the big movements and events, you know, the bad ones as well as the good ones, you know, it was all about ideologies and it was about solutions. And there was this, you know, this great human aspiration, which bleeds over and becomes hubris, that, you know, that we could solve the problems. I mean, even, you know, in physics, they thought they were just about to have the theory of everything. But what happens in individual life, in organizational life, in public life, in national life, in global life, you know, again and again, like, this is the human condition, the nature of reality, that that we, you know, what, however great are the answers we reach, this, you know, every great solution is always only temporary, is one way to say it.
You know, you write this beautifully on page.
I mean,
go ahead.
No, go on.
No, I wanted to quote you to you. I'm not surprised by the fact that inexplicable and terrible things happen in a cosmos as complicated as ours, with sentient beings like us running the show. But I'm emboldened by the fact that surprise is the only constant. We are never really running the show, never really in control, and nothing will go quite as we imagined it.
Nothing will ever go quite as we imagined it. And that is just this basic human truth. But we, you know, when I say we tried to retire mystery, I don't think there was an evil impulse. I think that it was an optimistic impulse. I think that we thought we could tie things up and you know, just always keep getting better and smarter and more perfect. And, you know, you remember in the 80s that, you know, this great political scientist said, we've reached the end of history. You know, things, we know what the solution, you know, we know what the perfect social system is. It's a liberal democracy with a capitalist underpinning, and we just have to keep perfecting it. And we know now that that's not true. And I think we're also relearning that it's, that it's not anything that is living, has surprise as the only constant, has mystery around the next corner, both for good and for ill. And so when I want to inject the word mystery back into our vocabulary and questions and curiosity, staying open, staying curious about what's going to happen next, I'm actually talking about us being more reality-based. Really, in fact, more logical, more, dealing in facts rather than illusions. But this way of thinking and this assumption that somehow we can always make it more perfect and tie things down and get rid of mystery is, this is the view of reality on which our organizations and systems and structures are still based. And a lot of them are failing us, and we're innovating new ways to do things, but it's very, right now it's all emergent, and it's easier to see what's failing and what's not working and to feel like we're flailing around in so many of our disciplines.
I think as I listen to you, that there are two things, there's so many more probably, but two things that stand in the way of our wanting to see reality as reality. I love how you put that. And one of them is we need to make plans and we need to make investments and we need to move forward in certain things. So that doesn't mean that we need easy answers, but we need to put a stake in the ground and say, while I don't know, I'm going to actually make this bet, right? And I think that's fine. Like we could do that without knowing. And I think admitting that we don't know leaves us open to seeing how things change and modifying them. The harder thing to overcome is the emotional response to not knowing, the fear that comes with that drives in many ways our desire for the easy answer, because if we think, history is over and we know everything there is to know, then there's nothing to be afraid of. We can control everything, when the reality is we can't. In your experience and in the conversations that you've had with people who very much as a profession think about and live with and explore the things that stop us from seeing reality as reality. What could you say to people that might help us manage the fear that comes with living in mystery?
Well, it's such an important point, that even while I want us to celebrate and the reality that there is mystery and surprise and uncertainty around every corner, we are actually not constituted, like physiologically, to handle that very well. So I'm also very much developing a new perspective, view of reality, mentality around this has to include a real huge measure of compassion and acknowledgement that some of us at any given time are either hardwired or better served by our circumstances to dwell with uncertainty, without it making us crazy. And the truth is, uncertainty does make us crazy as creatures when we are vulnerable. It's actually the hardest thing to deal with. Like, as humans, we actually know what to do with a real clear enemy and a real clear fight. And that is a very short supply right now. Mostly what we have in our workplaces, in our political life, in our, what's going on in our neighborhoods, in our kids' schools, in the economy is, it's just not adding up. It's not going the way we thought it was supposed to. But there aren't, it's more about these gaping questions and this uncertainty about how it can work or how it should work or how we have to refashion it to make it work. And that is very stressful for human beings. So part of opening up to mystery, as a strategy for being reality-based is absolutely about being grounded in that knowledge and you know, reckoning with that, that, you know, that this is a new human reality and we have to deal with the human aspect of it, the human condition aspect of it.
You know, the sense I get is a softness that in effect, you know, we're not all powerful, and to realize yeah. that allows us in some ways to be a little softer in judgment of ourselves and other people, and that there's great power in that kind of softness.
Yeah. And, you know, especially in the realm, I think, of business literature, but generally, so there's this new awakening we have to something very old, which is that failure and vulnerability are part of life, right? And I feel like, you know, people like Brené Brown, some of our neuroscientific, you know, just some of the ways we're starting to understand our brains and our bodies are inclining us to just start to see this as a fact, which, you know, flies in the face of this 20th century solutions-based, you know, all-powerful-based way of moving through the world. But then what's been done with it in some circles is we started to, like, build the failure into our like hero trajectory, right? So we acknowledge that failure happens, and I really do see this in, you know, in business as much as any place else, or like in education, we acknowledge, but then we turn it into a step on the way to our success. So we don't quite take in what we're learning, which is that that failure, that opening to softness and to vulnerability that in fact doesn't go away, even if it is a stepping stone on some path to success, again, is the only way to be rooted in reality, to develop resilience, which may contain a lot of power, but is distinct from mere power, which again is always going to be temporary.
I want to read a poem that you have in the book that I fell in love with and that I think has a voice in this conversation that we're having right now. And it's called Perfection, Perfection. Uh-huh. And it's by Father Killian McDonnell. Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Benedictine monk.
Benedictine monk. I have had it with perfection. I have packed my bags. I am out of here. Gone. As certain as rain will make you wet, perfection will do you in. It droppeth not as dew upon the summer grass to give liberty and green joy. Perfection straineth out the quality of mercy, withers rapture at its birth. Before the battle is half begun, cold probity thinks it can be won, concedes the war. I've handed in my notice, given back my keys, signed my severance check, I quit. Hints I could have taken. Even the perfect chiseled form of Michelangelo's radiant David squints. The Venus de Milo has no arms. The Liberty Bell is cracked.
Isn't that great?
I love it. I yeah. love it.
Yeah.
What specifically drew you to the poem?
Oh, well, it's about me. I mean, like, I can talk about these things because this is my struggle. I'm not talking about something abstract in the world out there. I mean, I am a living, breathing embodiment of somebody who knows these deep truths about not just humanity, but about my humanity. But it grew up, you know, I was born in 1960, grew up with that, in that world where I could make the world, I would save the world. You know, my father was like the classic self-made man. And I have always been so hard on myself. You know, it's costly and it's exhausting to carry around those high standards and to need to have that projection of not failing, not being vulnerable. So when I have these conversations all the time with people who many of, I mean, you know, people who are wise, or even people who become saints are themselves. I mean, you don't become wise. You become wise through these struggles, right? Through grappling with these things. So I have these conversations. I listen to people who've learned something, and who live with this gracefully, and always imperfectly. Partly because I need to, right? Because I am always grappling with this myself.
As am I. As am I.
Yeah.
You wrote in the section on words, and I'm probably doing this in reverse order because I want to ask you about why you broke the book up into the virtues that you did. But this quote really struck me and feels important for leaders everywhere. You wrote, "My only measure of the strength of a question now is in the honesty and eloquence it elicits." And I think this idea of generous listening is so important for leaders. Oftentimes I hear people, myself too, ask questions to make a point.
Right.
And I think there's so much that I would love to hear from you about, you know, you ask questions for a living that does successfully elicit sort of honesty and eloquence. What's the trick? What advice do you have, in a sense, to help people be in that state of mind and being that allows them to probe in that way?
I think that there are certain muscles, you know, spiritual muscles, social muscles that we have, that we train culturally. And having good answers and being good in an argument and representing your positions and, you know, debating. I mean, I was a high school debater, right? But these are things that we value and that we need. But in school and in family and in institutional life, we haven't, for a few generations at least, trained ourselves in being good questioners. And by that, I mean, you know, truly asking a question that you don't already know the answer to, that is not a part of your agenda, that, I sometimes say that, you know, that listening is not primarily about being quiet. It's about being present. And one quality of asking a generous question, of really being present as a listener, is in a willingness to be surprised. I mean, that's kind of a litmus test for, are you really asking this because you're curious?
And it's so countercultural in many ways. We ask questions to reinforce the points we're trying to make,
right?
So often.
You're right. We have like folded questions as performance pieces into that reverence we have for answers and opinions and, you know, advocacy. All good things, but not complete. And you know, I think right now in our political life, it's so dysfunctional. And it, to me, you know, talking about the gap between like how we're functioning now in a lot of our institutions, and the gap between that and what we are actually learning on our cutting edges about ourselves. It's almost to me like a lot of what is most visible right now is just a caricature of the worst things that went wrong with the 20th century, right? Like all of these worst qualities we're talking about, the extremes of being all about solutions and certainty. And, you know, having no questions left, which means actually having no curiosity about your fellow man, for one thing. It's countercultural, and it will take time. And I think it's something we have to start practicing as much as, you know, just deciding that we believe in. I mean, in journalism, so when I wrote that sentence you read, the way journalism has done this is the questions, you know, there's this idea of hard questions, and the hard question is really about how the journalist comes across. It's, you know, it's about them.
Mm-hmm.
And And I guess, you know, the what is the what? How would we measure the success of a hard question? It would be that, you know, that a point was made by the journalist, that the person on the other end of the interviews responds to inadequately or
gotcha
aggressively,
right? Kind of a
yeah.
gotcha.
Yeah. So what, but what you don't have, you may have revelation on the part of the journalist. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes in this scenario, the journalist is telling the world something, in this interview that they didn't know, but you don't have revelation. You're not going to elicit, revelation or real learning. The journalist is not going to be surprised in one of those situations, nor the person who's speaking is not going to be in an open enough place to say something that surprises themselves.
It's such a divergent way of being that I'm curious about your own journey, right? You started out as a journalist. I never read any of your really early stuff, and I don't know what kind of a journalist you were, but I imagine that there was some form of journey from the, you know, journalist who's trying to figure out how to get in the first paragraph the who, what, when, where, how,
yeah,
to the engagement that you have now with larger mysteries and virtues in the world. What helped you get there, and also what did you struggle with?
So I was very fortunate in my 20s to be in Germany and then in divided Berlin, and I was, you know, I ended up working in the New York Times Bureau, and I went to Berlin as the New York Times stringer, which had no guarantees of publication and no real money attached, but I ended up getting to having great teachers. And I value that so much, those disciplines of journalism. I got good at it, but I did not, what I didn't enjoy was, being reactive, right? Of that, you know, in that kind of journal. And there are people who are really good at this, and it's a calling, and I'm glad they're in the world, right? But for me, you were always waiting, you know, day by day, week by week, to see what the world would present that you would then turn your attention to. And then I also felt like I would get into a story, go into some depth, learn something, and then you immediately turn on to the next story that the world has presented for you to cover. And that just wasn't me. I wanted to keep going with something. I wanted to draw it out. And also, and this is, I feel more true now than it was then. I mean, this was like the 80s. You know, this was, I mean, some of my stuff is on the internet, but this was pre-internet. it was another world. And the ethos of journalism, which had its righteous place in the 20th century of uncovering injustice and exposing corruption, right? And it still has its place. But that is real, and we need to know about that, and we need people to be shining a light on that. But that is not the whole story of who we are as a species. It actually doesn't lead us to attend to the fullness of what is happening in our world that matters. Some of what is happening in the world that matters is life-giving, you know, is true innovation, is reality changing, is about expanding what human flourishing means in new ways. And this way we've done journalism is kind of, you know, what I keep saying. It's like we need these particular tools and these particular skills, but they're not sufficient. And as we've evolved into a 24/7, 21st century news environment, you just get bombarded by bad news and by the same bad news. And we don't internalize that as the story of the day, you know, the exceptional thing that happened. we start to internalize this as the norm, and it's bad for us. There's a lot of demoralization. Now, what I also am aware of, and you know, as aware now as I ever have been, is it's there's something in us, in these primitive parts of our brain, that is very reactive. It's that is riveted by bad news and catastrophe. You know, it's this part of us that knows what to do with a fight, and that knows what to do with an enemy, and that knows what to do in real danger. So one of the puzzles that I work with is, yeah, how to make good news riveting. And it's not. I mean, it's, you know, it's often, it can be really boring when journalists or news organizations try to say, well, we're going to cover good news. It's not the same. So, but what I started having these conversations at that monastery, at a board of this project that had come out of that monastery that Father Killian was at. And it was through conversations with some of these lives, these great, big, full, rich lives that had all the human pathos and drama in them that all of our human lives have, but also had committed themselves to something life-giving, often quiet, you know, not having a publicist, but having like all these ripple effects, you know, which is the way a lot of good works in the world. And so I found that conversation, those conversations, so much more interesting than I expected, and such a contrast to the, you know, the media interviews that I was used to hearing. So that, you know, that's kind of how this was all very gradual. You know, it was kind of one thing after the other. It wasn't like this great vision formed.
But even your use of the language elucidates that, right? Because the idea, the word conversation, right,
yeah,
is in itself evocative, right? A conversation is two ways. A conversation suggests sort of thoughtfulness and listening and sharing and some degree of not knowing. And I think when I would think and talk to journalists, I don't know that they would describe what they do as conversations as much as, you know, questions and answers.
Yeah.
And I think that's true for organizations too. I think there's so much, leaders are often more comfortable with statements than with conversations. And it feels important. You know, the other thing that you said that it brings me to another quote, I've underlined a lot of your book. And it's something very profound, I think, about what the world needs and the sense of how serious we can be about saying, you know, this is, I need to play this role in the world, and recognizing that every role is important, and that, you know, you describe yourself in a journalistic role that wasn't a comfortable fit for you, and it allowed you to move in this other direction. And the idea that, yes, we need those kinds of journalists, we also need your kinds of journalists. Like, it's not an either or. And the quote which seems to bear on this is, I worry perhaps too late about the earnestness of my reflections, the seriousness of this writing. For there is in me and in this world of burgeoning wisdom, I spend my life watching, a newfound ease in play and pleasure and joy. Hope is not all heavy with meaning. Wisdom is not all apparently purposeful. It wouldn't be progress if it were.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, I love that you put this quote right after mentioning Sylvia Boorstein, who I know and who is full of, you know, love and laughter
and funny.
Funny. I mean, right, exactly. Yeah. And you didn't necessarily connect the two things, but they were, you know, knowing Sylvia, they were connected in my mind. I was like, oh, of course you would put this paragraph after mentioning Sylvia. And I think the broadness of what we can do and how we can do it, that there's room for seriousness and there's room for play and there's room for wisdom and there's actually room for stupidity, you know, like there's really room for all of it.
Yes. And this is part of, I think, what goes wrong with why we can't figure out how good news is interesting, because we steal all the joy out of it, because we try to present it and package it as in the serious way that we present and package what went terribly wrong today.
You know, I don't know what to do with this, but the thing that comes up for me is I feel like presenting and packaging destroys the world in many ways. And I find myself playing a role in that. I mean, I run a leadership training and I think about, well, so how do we frame this and how do we package this and how do we, and it's actually my most hated work, I have to admit. Like, it's the stuff that I dislike the most, and yet I still find myself doing it because I want to present in a certain way. And I feel like the more we are able to move from, I'll use that word again, from presentation to conversation, the more we could muse and explore without having to package and present. But I don't know exactly how to do that, even in my own life.
Yeah, and I think we have to accompany each other in learning that and figuring it out, because it's not instinctive. What is instinctive now and what we have all kinds of models for is what you're talking about, is packaging and framing. We know how to do that. But we are, I believe, being called to really behave in very radically different ways from the way we have behaved as individuals in all kinds of organizations. You know, our muscle memory is not serving us now, even when we can see what's not working as it should. So, and part of, I think, what we have to let, we get to let the joy of this be is, first of all, you know, naming delight as a virtue and saying, you know, this should be this, you know, one way we should know we're walking in the right direction is it feels good. I believe that.
Right.
I mean, there's a hedonistic way to do that, but I'm not going to let that stop me from saying that, because I think that is true. And, you know, I take a lot of, one of my models for this is the local, like what's happening in the realm of food, how we are having to just reckon with how we went awry in the name of progress and innovation and turned food from real to unreal. And we're having to like undo decades of, you know, not just eating habits, but agriculture and industry and standards and all of that. But the people who are in the forefront of that movement have this great, you know, they are insisting that one of the things that drives them for that they can let themselves be driven forward by pleasure, because, you know, ultimately better taste is a litmus test of whether something is more humanely produced and grown and cooked. And in touch with the community. So like, this is a wonderful model we have in front of us, because this is one of the places that we are healing and that we are actually advancing. And so, you know, what would be the corollary to that, the analogy to that in other disciplines, I mean, in our business life. And I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think we get to walk it together, and we have to insist that, there should be real joy in it, you know, not in every moment, not in everything, but as part of the experience.
I love that. Krista, you broke the book into virtues, words, body, love, faith, and hope. Why those? They seem critical for leadership as well as living. Mm. And I'm not even sure of my question, but I'm wondering, you know, how you selected those. They're not like even words. It's not, and flesh. Flesh was an important chapter for me.
Yeah, me too.
And I think it's so forgotten. I mean, you're talking about it now. You're talking about the physical pleasure of eating, and letting that guide us. Letting I'm gonna butcher, because I don't have it in front of me and I don't know it by heart. But Mary Oliver's line, you know, let the soft animal of your body do what it does.
And love what it
love
loves.
What it loves. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Love what it loves. I love that poem.
Yeah.
And it's and I think we don't follow suit. So I think they were beautifully chosen. I'm wondering how you made those decisions.
It was completely emergent, and it was born of a lot of struggle and doing it wrong and making mistakes and feeling completely in despair that I would ever be able to finish this. So
I know that feeling.
Oh, it's because I started out with an idea of, I don't know, 10 or 12 chapters, and they had these poetic titles, things like time and mystery and virtues. And it was just this process of getting it wrong and, you know, knowing it was wrong and not knowing how to make it right, but just knowing it wasn't working and simplifying. I mean, that sort of like mystery or virtues that I thought would be chapters. I started to realize, now these run all the way through it. They run all the way through it. They run through every chapter. And I think also a big turn was that when I was initially following this question that people have asked me across the years, which is, you've interviewed all these wise people. What are the common denominators? Right. This is our desire to break it down.
And I want the answer.
Right,
I want the answer.
Right. Present it. But something that is so important to me that has become, you know, ever more important to me as I've done the show, and that I realized as, you know, once I was well into trying to write and frame the book, is that this idea of wisdom and this idea of, you know, spiritual genius was this phrase of Einstein, that there's such a thing as spiritual genius in the world, that we need as much as we need objective knowledge, that this is not about exceptional, rare people out there like Mother Teresa. It's that wisdom is available. It is accessible. It's something we can all cultivate. It's also not something you have to be 90 to possess, although it is going to look different at 90 than it does at 29. But, you know, there's a very special wisdom at 29, and there's a special wisdom at 45, and there's a special wisdom at 6. And it's something we can... also that it's there for all of us to cultivate, and that it emerges through the basic raw materials of our lives, right? So that's where I started correcting myself. I mean, I can write a fancy chapter about a perception of time or about mystery, or about virtues, like putting, you know, isolating virtues out. But that wasn't true, actually, to what I've learned, and not just to what I hear from other people, but what I've learned in my own life and in trying to incorporate, you know, the example of these people into my life, that it's very elemental. And I mean, this is good news, right? It's taking seriously that the words that come out of our mouths, when this is something we do all day, every day with everybody we interact with, just about the power in that, and our power to take that seriously and to have, you know, the words that we speak and write and use and elicit from others, to let, you know, to shape that, to shape ourselves so that that is more life-giving and generous, and that it leaves a much more beautiful imprint on the world. And I mean, this is a really simple thing that we know but rarely pause to consider, how, you know, in the course of any day, you can have an exchange with someone. You can say something to somebody, or somebody can say something to you that ruins your day or makes it. Mm-hmm. Right? And just so that wisdom is in that kind of acknowledgement and really working with that. And it's the same thing with, you know, how we inhabit our bodies and how that makes us attentive to the physicality of others and to everything around us, and, you know, on love, you know, opening that up, faith, which is a, you know, too small a word for, you know, this part of ourselves where we grapple with mystery and the human condition, and hope, which is, I think, a renewable resource, and it's a choice. But again, these are very, very elemental aspects of any life in with infinite variety.
You know, you end with faith, as you were talking just now, and it brings me to a quote of yours that gave me so much hope, actually, and fell on me so powerfully. Even as I say, let's be, you know, let's live in our curiosity. You spoke this quote with a certainty that made so much sense to me. You wrote, "Who am I to speak for God? But this I believe. If God is God, And that in itself is a crazy shorthand begging volumes of unfolding of the question. He, she does not need us craven. He, she desires us, needs us, grateful and attentive and courageous in the everyday. There's so much profundity in that, and it cuts through so much noise. I want to appreciate you for that, and I don't know if you have any additional thoughts. I don't know if it needs additional thoughts, but it really landed very powerfully for me.
Well, thank you. I mean, you know, that's a really intimate piece of writing. I'm partly because I take words so seriously. I sometimes, you know, I hesitate to use the words that mean the most, and God is one of those words, and the words that mean the most and yet are so inadequate. And yet, as St. Augustine said, we speak in order not to remain completely silent about some of this. And so I would just say it means a lot to me that you, it's so wonderful to hear that read back to me. But it's scary to write about these things. And, I went to seminary before I started this radio show, not wanting to be a minister, but just wanting to get into theology and understand it. And there's something about it. This is an impossible thing to talk about. It's an impossible thing to be in conversation about, these great questions of meaning and religion, and yet we have to, I think we, and they're hard to talk about, and they are scary to talk about, and even when you read it to me, it feels presumptuous for me to say anything about God, even though I qualified it all the way through. And yet we long to talk about these things, and we don't have a robust vocabulary for talking about these things, and we have a robust vocabulary for talking about all kinds of other things, like money and sex and, what the Kardashians are doing today. And right. I mean, I think this is important enough. And actually it's so exciting, you know, when you do venture into this kind of conversation, we're ready for it, but we have to learn it. We have to kind of learn it together, and we have to teach each other together. And I think kind of push the boundaries of what now feels possible and even socially acceptable.
I want to confess that even as I was, listening to you and about to read that quote, I had a hesitation, and my hesitation was, you know, I know this moved me and touched me deeply, and this is a show for leaders on leadership and business and organizations, and we're going to talk about God. And I had the same feeling that you had, which is, you know, it is intimate and important, and I think so often even brought into the conversation of life in ways that are public and draw away from the intimacy in a way that can be damaging. And so I'm touched that you were touched by bringing it in, and that you and that you brought it in. And I think it's the sort of where I want to be in conversations. So I appreciate that.
You know, when I mean, my 20s, in all these years, I was a journalist, and then I was with the State Department in divided Berlin. I was a completely political person. I was ambitious. I wanted to make the world a better place. I was interested in power. I wanted to be close to real power and not fake power, you know. And, where was I going to go with that? And I was fluent in German, and I didn't talk about religion or about these questions of meaning. I mean, I talked about political meaning, and what was going on in divided Germany was very existential and, you know, really had these religious overtones in its way. But I dismissed this whole part of life and these kinds of questions and, you know, whatever spiritual life is for a long time. And that was the fashionable thing to do. And I didn't know anyone. And I knew a lot of wonderful, impressive people. And I didn't know anybody in those years in that place who talked about these things. But when I then, you know, made this big shift in my life, this very odd series of events and changes of heart and starting to ask spiritual questions and not even wanting to call them that because I didn't think it was respectable. But when I then started telling people in my previous life, you know, and these are mostly people in Europe and the UK and in Germany, but also Americans, diplomats, journalists, very, very smart people. What happened, and this happens to me still, is people start coming out of the closet, right? Like, so it turns out, you know, people were thinking about these things. Some people were going to church or synagogue, even if they weren't. I mean, these are the questions, and we do want to at least dance around and have some curiosity about what this part of ourselves is and what it could be. And we all hit these moments in life where we need to delve into whatever this is and what it can be for us, and where we hit the limits of our so-called rational disciplines. But again, so I go through the world with people, you know, saying like, I didn't, you know, that it turns out it's there. But again, we don't know how to name it. We don't know how to talk about it in a way that feels respectable and substantive. And I think there's probably a sense in which, you know, it served me so well that I also came from that place myself, right? I mean, I'm not a stranger to that ambivalence, right? I live that too.
Which is the mystery.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Let me just ask you a final question, which is that you, and this is sort of the final, it's such a misnomer because it's the final question that could take 6 hours. Mm-hmm. You've had all of these unbelievable conversations with incredibly loving, faithful, embodied, hopeful, articulate people. How has that impacted your life and how you live your life day to day? So not even necessarily not even simply, there's nothing simple about any of it, but the world's view, but, you know, in the way that you move through the world on a day-to-day basis, how can you think of ways in which these conversations, these relationships that you've developed through conversations have changed who you are and what you do and how you walk through the world?
Yeah. You know, that's a question I ask people, and I think this is the first time somebody's asked me this so pointedly, and it's a very challenging question. But like you can't ask this question in the first 5 minutes, right? Like, we're at a place now where we have been in conversation, and I'm ready to, you know, open that door to myself and think about that. I mean, I would say when I do any individual interview, I do all this preparation and kind of steeping myself in how, you know, not just what somebody knows, but how they think. And let's say in any given interview, I always take something away that I carry around with me. You started with this idea of mystery, and the reality of mystery and is very present for me now and very thrilling. And what that means on a more practical level is that it makes me, you know, ever more comfortable with, I need to tie up less and less.
Hmm.
I think it's a good thing. Robert Coles, who I interviewed years ago, said mystery is a great companion. And I'm also thinking about the rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who said, you know, that you know, part of the reason that if you stop being surprised or surprisable, that you're not alive anymore, and that, you know, he wakes up every morning and can take joy and gratitude in existence because, you know, he's never ceases to be surprised. And by the same token, he can't reconcile himself to injustice. He's always surprised that it's this animating thing. And so I think that having the conversations the way I do, the way I've learned to do them over time, just it flexes that muscle in me. I have all the same challenges that anybody else has. I sometimes worry that people have, you know, think, have put my life up on a pedestal and imagine that because I steep myself in wisdom, you know, that I don't feel like I'm a bad parent half the time and, you know, have my days of darkness and go through all the crises that everybody else goes through, you know. But I would say one real liberation of this life of conversation is, as you say, I talk to people who have learned to live gracefully and who are really learning things. And, you know, they may be physicists and they may be poets or theologians. But because people open up with me, what I know is that everybody's life is like this. Even, you know, Desmond Tutu's life is like this, and the Dalai Lama in his bizarre way. It's everyone that lives of wisdom and beauty and grace emerge through all the things that go wrong, and not in spite of them, and not because people have had some kind of privilege or been shielded from what goes wrong. And that is still, even knowing that as I do and having seen it reinforced time after time through these conversations, that doesn't mean that I don't flinch and dread it and, you know, wish it weren't happening when I hit those moments in my life. I do. But I think that the kind of ongoing conversation and reflection about this does give me these really practical tools and these, you know, I do feel accompanied by just being in this conversation and knowing these people are out there. It gives me ways to kind of pin whatever is going wrong to, you know, deeper wisdom, some kind of perspective that doesn't make things better, but it helps you inhabit it more fully. And, you know, that the beautiful and terrible thing that we know is that it's not about what goes wrong for you. It's about how you walk through it to the other side. And I mean, I've just been going through a hard, really challenging year on a number of levels, and just took my second last child to college. And so I'm like facing this, you know, the end of 22 years of being an active parent. So this is a grief, right? This is a loss. It's a grief, and it's not something I don't wish it weren't happening, because it's the right thing for my son. But I have all these tools and all these voices in my head and mostly what they tell me is to really let myself not wish it weren't happening, but to understand, you know, to walk through it and be with it and inhabit what is happening. And to know that in that, I will be able to find, to discern, to experience, to discover what wisdom and whatever, you know, is life-giving in it that I can walk out the other side with.
The book is Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. Krista, it is such a pleasure to speak with you, and I love what you have said, and I, you know, it brings me back to this perfection poem, right? I mean, it's you know, and it's done. I'm done. That the reality of life is so much more complicated. I'm just very appreciative of your spending the time with us and sharing your perspective on the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
And, you know, I will just say, and don't you think also that it's in terms of leadership, because, you know, I'm an organizational leader now for the last 3 years, which I wasn't before, but it's just the same dynamic, and it's very hard, and things do go wrong, and it's right. And I don't think fewer things go wrong, but if there's something new and good that's happening, it's letting it in. That, right, that rather than having to be the leader or the parent, you know, because we modeled this in all of our places, who never had any questions alongside their answers, for whom, you know, where to acknowledge a weakness or a mistake would be failing. Just to be able to open ourselves to that, to the fullness of ourselves and the possibilities that open up when we let that reality be in the room. I mean, that in itself is great. It's a great opening.
And it's a humility, right? It's there's a humility that says, I don't know how this is going to pan out or turn out. Or, you know, it reminds me of this Buddhist story of the man who had one horse, and the horse escapes, and all of his neighbors come and say, how unfortunate. And then the horse comes back with 10 wild horses. And he says, when they say how unfortunate, they said, you know, who knows? And they come back, and he's got the wild horse brought back 10 wild horses. And all of his neighbors say, how fortunate. And he says, who knows? And then his son is trying to train one of the wild horses and gets thrown from it and breaks his leg. And everyone says, how unfortunate. And he says, who knows? And then the army comes to conscript all the young men, but leave his son because he has a broken leg. And they say, how fortunate, you know, and it could just go on and on and
right,
on and on.
Right.
And the humility that says, like, we don't know. Mm-hmm. And but we can be with it. And as you were talking about the grief that you feel, along with the joy of your son leaving for college, and I have so many friends who are in this situation, yeah. you know, this week. It makes me feel like it's a gift to see the grief itself as a gift also.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Not to fight right. the fact of it. Well, it's really been a great conversation. I've so enjoyed myself, and it's lovely to meet you, and thank you for having me on your podcast.
Thanks, Krista. If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.